The two covenants. You already have in your mind some concept of what the two covenants is all about. Sometimes we talk about the three ages of Bible history. And the way we have referred to that is the patriarchal age, the Mosaical age, and the Christian age. When we talk about the two covenants, we talk about the Old Testament and the New Testament. The word patriarch is used in the Bible, and the way it's used in the Bible ought to create a problem in our terminology when we talk about the patriarchal age. Do you know that David is called a patriarch? And so if we talk about the patriarchal age, then how on earth can David be in the patriarchal age? And so we'll discuss that, obviously, and talk about that. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to take a pew Bible, not your own Bible. Grab one of the pew Bibles so we look at the same page, and this will be the only week we'll do that. But pick up a pew Bible and open it up, and right at the very, very beginning, you've got the preface. You ever see that in the Bible? Have you ever read the preface in the Bible you regularly used? I am amazed how many people have the Bible they've used for years, and they've never read the preface. And we're not going to read the preface in here. We're not going to talk about versions at all. And if I mention one of these paragraphs, you will stop listening and read the paragraph, right? So should I or should I not go ahead and mention this section? I would really encourage you to read. And know that when I tell you that, for the next 2 minutes, you will be reading this paragraph. But in the preface there, you've got complete equivalence in translation. And I call attention to that to point out the fact that translators are faced looking at words in one language and trying to bring those words over into another language. And so there is probably the most popular translation in America today is the NIV, the New International Version. And it uses the concept of dynamic equivalence. And so you got two concepts here, complete equivalence, dynamic equivalence. And dynamic equivalence allows the interpreters to get away from any concept of looking at every word that is in the Bible in the original language, though they'll look, obviously, and read in the original language at every word. But their intent is not to give a word-for-word translation, but to give the equivalent English words in a dynamic fashion. And that in and of itself is creates some situations because the Bible is verbally inspired, and that's not our study here. But sometimes Jesus would make arguments based on a single word in the Old Testament. Jesus studied the Bible by looking at every word in the Old Testament. When they asked him about the resurrection of the dead, the Sadducees came and asked Jesus about the resurrection of the dead. What's that, Matthew 22? They came and asked Jesus about the resurrection of the dead. And Jesus said, you want to know about the resurrection of the dead? Go back and read the Old Testament at the burning bush where God said to Moses, I was the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Why are you shaking your heads? No. That's not what he said. Now, wait a minute. Betty, what did your father do for a living?
I don't remember.
You don't remember. What, what did an uncle of yours do for a living? Okay.
Worked in the coal mine.
Now, use a verb. He is working in the coal mine?
He did work.
He was working in the coal mine. Is and was. See what I'm talking about? At the burning bush, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had been dead for 400 plus years. And God said to Moses, 400 years after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob lived on this earth, I am the God of Abraham. Not I was. You don't talk about your dead relatives in the present tense. My father is a good man, was a good man. Whichever word you use, I'll know whether he's living or dead or whether you're dumb. Well, you know, one or the other. You know, you talk about people who are dead in the past tense, do you not? And so let's look at that just so you'll see that I'm not making this up. It's in Matthew 22. Matthew 22, page 872, if you want to cheat a little bit. The Sadducees in verse 23, who say there is no resurrection, came to him saying, Master, Moses said that if a man dies having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. And there were seven brothers. The first one died. She married the second brother. She married the third brother, the fourth brother, the fifth brother, the sixth brother, the seventh brother, because all of these guys are dying. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'd been husband number six, or husband number seven, I think I would have said, would somebody check that woman's cooking? She's married all, and every one of them's dying. Now, they've got a dilemma because, and there's no answer to this, whenever, verse 26, the second died also, and the third, and even to the seventh, last of all, verse 27, the woman died. In the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? And Jesus said, you are mistaken, not knowing the Scriptures nor the power of God. Power of God, God can fix anything. God doesn't have any problems. But he says, you do err, not knowing the Scriptures. What Scripture did they not know? He says, verse 31, concerning the resurrection of the dead, have you not read which was spoken to you by God, saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You know what Jesus said? You could look at that one verse in the Old Testament. Look at that one verse in the Old Testament and know there's going to be a resurrection. And you can look at it and look at the tense of that verb in one word in the Old Testament. And so in translation, and it's not our purpose to talk about translation, are you finished reading Complete Equivalents now? Can I go ahead now if you've been reading Complete Equivalents? Complete Equivalents says we're not going to be dynamic. We're going to try to retain the old King James concept of word for word as far as possible so that it puts you standing in the position of the person who reads the original language. I mean, that's really what is involved in translation. In the United Nations, don't tell me what you think, you know, the ambassador to the Ukraine meant when he said what he said in the Ukrainian language, if there is such a thing. Don't you tell me what you think he meant to say. You tell me what he said, and let me figure out what the impact of those words. And all of that's involved in translation. And the concept of dynamic equivalence gives the translators leeway to state it stronger and sometimes not as accurately. It doesn't give you quite as much insight into that. That's not our purpose to look at that. I just called attention to that because if you've never read the preface to the Bible you usually use, you ought to sit down and read it. You'd be amazed how educational it is in relationship to it. Okay, I'm turning the page after I get out to the preface to a page called The Table of Contents. You see the table of contents, and I don't have a page number, but it's about three or four pages into the book. Look at the table of contents, and tell me what a table of contents tells you.
Listing of the contents.
It is a table that has the contents in it. I'm telling you, my high school, junior high teachers, they were wrong. You can define a word using the word. I don't know if you were ever told that you can't define a word by using the word. I can do it and do it better. A table of contents is a table that shows the content. Have it in so many books. Even sometimes in novels, you'll have a table of contents. It'll say chapter one on such and such a page, and every time, sometimes there's a discussion of what is found within that. So I open up the Bible, and I see the table of contents. And then, as I open up the Bible, I see this section introductions. Section introduction, it says the first one is on page 2. So just turn the page and look at the section introduction, the Pentateuch. Now, did God write page 2 in the Bible? No. We may not even know what the word Pentateuch is. We may not, it may be a word that is different for us. But what that is, and many Bibles have them, are words, are pages put in the Bible that are study helps. And so you pick up the Bible and in this particular Bible, you've got page 2 and you've got that discussion. Because the individuals who printed this Bible, and perhaps the translators may have been involved in it, but at least those who printed the Bible said, we want to show you what's in this book. And so at the introduction to various chapters, or various sections of the Bible, not chapters, but various books of the Bible, they put a introductory page to tell you what that page is all about. Now, there are other helps. Sometimes, and this Bible does not have it, but sometimes Bibles have center column references. Look at back on page 3 to the book of Genesis. You see how you have two columns? Some Bibles have a center column reference. Would somebody define to me what a center column reference is? It's a column in the center that has references. Now, we may not know what references mean, but sometimes you'll look in the Bible, and this Bible, by the way, does not have a center column at all. It just has two columns. But your own personal Bible may have center column references. And so in a verse, there will be a little tiny A or a little tiny B. And so you find that A or that B, and you look into the center column, and there's a cross reference where that phrase in that verse is discussed elsewhere. Inspired or uninspired? Center column reference. Did God write center column references? Nope. But they're good, are they not? For example, have you not read that God said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? Wonder where that's found. If you had a Bible that had center column references, right somewhere in that verse, have you not read, there'd be a little tiny A or a B or X or an M or some letter like that. And you look over in that center column reference and it'll show you back in Exodus chapter 3. I'm not sure what verse, but it'll show you the verse in Exodus chapter 3 about the burning bush. And so you've got center column references. Now, I say that to help you and to encourage you to use center column references. I really, really like, I know some of you use the New American Standard. I believe the Bible, the translation that has the strongest center column references is the New American Standard. I really, really love that. Now, your center column references likely will not be the same as somebody else's center column references because those individuals who decided to print the Bible, they decided which verses they'd put in the center column references. Now then, sometimes in the center column, you'll not just have an A or a B or a C. You'll have a number of 1, 2, or 3 sometimes. And usually that is in the center column, reference in relationship to that verse, and it indicates a comment being made that is not a reference to something else in the Bible, another verse, another reference in the Bible, another passage in the Bible, but it is a word that explains. And sometimes the New American Standards will have the word literally, L-I-T is the way it's usually abbreviated. And so you look at it and you've got the literal, this is literally the word that was used in the original language. And because that doesn't flow and we might not be able to fully understand it, they've tried to give it, but they want you to know that the word over here literally is this word. And so I would strongly urge you to use center column references. They're really, really important. Now then, look at page 3 and look down at the bottom of page 1. Do you see down there in the bold print, in the Pew Bibles, Genesis chapter 1, you see that 1:2. You see down at the very bottom of the page. Are you too old to see that small print? Need a magnifying glass to see that. And so it says at chapter 1, verse 2, words in italic types have been added for clarity. They are not found in the original Hebrew or Aramaic. It's the language of the Old Testament. And so the translators, because they want you to be able to have confidence in reading the Bible, sometimes in the center column reference, they'll say, literally, this is the word literally found over there. I don't know that that occurs very much in the King James or the New King James. But uniformly in the King James and the New King James, when a word is italicized, that is an indication that that word is not in the original, but the translators put that word there thinking that the presence of that word might help you to understand that better. For example, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, love is not, and the word's provoked. Is there a word before provoked? Love is not easily provoked. Guess what? It's in italics. And they put the word in there. You see, that says, yep, love provokes me some of the time. Well, that's not really exactly what's... Love is not provoked. But so the translators think, boy, that's pretty harsh. Need to soften that up a little bit. And so they... And so what I do when I read a verse and the verse is in italics, I read that verse and leave the italics out sometimes to see if it says something different to me. Because the Bible is verbally inspired. Now then, go back to the table of contents. After you have the special section pages that are there, that are listed underneath that, then in bold print, you have the Old Testament and the New Testament. How many books are in the Old Testament? 39. Now, I remember things by putting them in my head, twisting them, and sliding them in that way. If I put them in straight up, they just drop right out, okay? How many letters in the word old? 3. How many letters in the word testament? If you spell the word testament right. I actually feel sorry for somebody that is so limited they cannot spell words in more than one way, okay? But how many letters in the word testament? 9. Old Testament. How many books in the Old Testament? 39. Now, you're smart enough. You don't have to remember it that way, okay? Okay. How many books in the New Testament? What is 3 times 9? Diane, I just love your face. Oh, she says, thank you. Okay. 3 times 9 is what? 27. How many books in the New Testament? 27. Now see, if when you were little, you sat in one of these classrooms down here, and you've known that since you were 3 years of age, you know, Troy knows that. I mean, you know, Troy knows that, and he'll forever know it. But if it's slipping and you're losing, or if you've come into the church later in your life, that might be a good way to remember. How many books in the Old Testament? 39. How many books in the New Testament? 27. Now then, look at the books and recognize that the names given to the book were not written by God. And so we have a book called Genesis. Genesis. Here is this first book in the Bible, and we have the word Genesis in it. It's rather ironic, by the way. The Old Testament is written in what language? Hebrew, primarily Hebrew, a little Aramaic. Remember that over there on the bottom of that page, Hebrew and Aramaic. Primarily Hebrew. And yet the name of the book is not a Hebrew word. That's amazing. Genesis is a Greek word. And so when the Bible was translated into the Greek language in, you know, about 250 B.C., 250 years before Christ, they named some books. In the Hebrew, and I don't speak Hebrew, but the first three words in Hebrew, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the Hebrew Bible, that's the name of the book. But if we were to say that Hebrew word, very few of us would understand that as even the name of a book in the Bible. Now then, what does the word Genesis mean? You're probably going to have to use some word other than the word to define the word. What's the word Genesis mean? Beginning. Seriously, when you say Genesis, you're saying a Greek word. You're speaking Greek. So, aren't you glad here? You'll be a Greek scholar by the time this is over, okay? You've got Genesis. Now, the question is, what does Genesis mean? It means beginning. And so to refer to this book, the Hebrews and the Greeks, whenever the Bible was translated into Greek, and Americans, when we read the English Bible, say the equivalent of the first three words in the entire Bible. In the beginning. That's where that name comes from. So Genesis is a book about beginnings. Okay, you'll have to talk loud because I'm legally deaf what begins in the book of Genesis? Shout it out. One at a time, please. I've only got 2 ears and one of them is stopped up. What's in the book of Genesis? Beginning of what? Somebody have to tell me what they said.
Creation.
Creation, all right. Beginning of? There's no wrong answer to this, by the way, because there was nothing before this, so anything that exists, you're probably going to be all right, okay?
Civilization.
What?
Civilization.
Civilization? What?
The Word.
The Word? Interesting. You've been to college. Tina, it's working. Now, don't be like that kid that came home and his father was so proud of him. He said, now, son, you've been off to college. Speak some college to us. And so the boy, not wanting to disappoint his father, said, pi r squared. And his father said, I don't know what they're teaching up there, but pi r round. Okay. In the beginning was the Word, and He was there before the beginning. You got me there. Okay. I said anything that exists, almost anything except God and Jesus and angels and the Holy Spirit is found in Genesis. What else? Sin, redemption, promises, languages, nations, and civilization kind of thing. It's the book of beginnings. There are three questions that are inherently within the minds of individuals if they think about it. Number one, where did I come from? Number two, where am I going? What happens when I die? We don't like to think about it. We don't like to think about dying. That's why individuals don't have wills. Folks, most of you in this room are old enough you need wills. I'm serious about that. You're going to create a fussing among your kids, and whatever possessions you have will be squandered unless you make some provision in your will. What's going to happen when I die? Let's forget about the will side of it. Am I like an animal? Is there no difference between me and the dog? You've heard that expression, a man's is not like a dog named Rover who, when he dies, is dead all over. That's not me. Yeah. I've lived in this body 70 plus years, and I am inside this body. You got that concept? This body's wearing out. Diane, don't you feel like you're about 30 inside your head? I didn't say in your body. Yeah. Maybe even younger.
About 100 in my body.
Yes. my body, you know, I can still... Gary, I can still take that basketball and make those shots like I could when I was in junior high, high school. My body just won't cooperate. I still have the moves. I'm telling you, I've got it. I just envision. He goes this way. I know which way. I've got it. I'm living inside this body. The dust returns to the earth from whence it came. What's Adam made from? Adam died. The dust, God formed man of the dust of the ground. When Adam died, what happened? The dust returned to the earth from whence it came. The rest of that verse, but when you die, the dust returns to the earth from whence it came, but the Spirit from God who gave it. I want you to hear that God who gave it and come to a realization that I existed before I had a body. God gave me this body, which says, I existed before this body. That's why the Bible talks about in Hebrews 12, He is the Father of spirits. That in and of itself ought to tell us something about abortion. Just that one phrase, the Father, not the Father of spirits, but the Spirit returns to God who gave it. When God gave the Spirit, He put it in a body. And when it dies, it comes back, it returns to God who gave it. Okay, let's back up again. Here you have... Here you have this understanding of these spiritual matters. And so you've got God's dealing with man, and in the beginning, this is how it all started. That's remarkable, isn't it? Genesis. Those questions. Where'd I come from? What happens when I die? You know the other question? And no one wants to think about this question. It's too hard to think about. Why am I here? Why am I here? Now, my son Gary's not here. He always fusses me when I use old-fashioned illustration. He says, nobody knows who O.J. Simpson is. You know? And so, young people, you can just tune out, okay? You only live once. Live life once or come. Live it with all the gusto you can. Anybody remember that? You're telling your age, Tina. Anybody remember? Beer commercial. Beer commercial. You only go around once. Live it with all the gusto you can. Over and over and over and over. It's trying to say, here's what life is all about. You got this much of it. Enjoy it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. If Gary were here, I would say, that's in the Bible. And it came from Greek philosophy, the Epicurean philosophy of the ancient Greeks. And that's still around, but nobody remembers. Live with all the gusto you can. Now see, the Bible answers that question. If this book is from God, if it is, then it answers all three questions. All three questions. Genesis. Now then, Genesis, look at the name of the book. Turn the page and look at the name of the book. In the Pew Bible. Look at the name of the book in the Pew Bible. What is the name given to this book? Now, don't just say Genesis. There's more to that. Can you read that? The first book of Moses. I wonder if there's a second book that Moses wrote. Wonder if there's a page in this Bible that says the second book of Moses. And if there's a page in this Bible that says the third book of Moses and the fourth book of Moses and the fifth book of Moses. I hear pages turning. Somebody's going to find me wrong or find me right one way or the other. What's the second book of Moses? Exodus. Third book? Leviticus. Numbers. Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, fifth book of Moses. Where's that come from? Well, the Jews gave names to the book. And by the way, the New Testament quotes Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy and attributes the authorship to Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy to Moses. So we're not just dependent on the Jews' names of this book, because four of these five books, the New Testament, attributes these words to Moses. Have you not read what Moses said? Jesus said that more than once. And so it's attributed to Moses. And so we know the Jews were absolutely right in getting Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy as the second, third, fourth, and fifth book of Moses. And from that same nation, the Jewish nation, from that same nation that gave us Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, we have another book, and that nation says, and this book was written by Moses. Now then, that's interesting. How many Bibles did Adam have? Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Isn't that remarkable? I am, at the burning bush, God said, I am the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Had Moses ever read that? I mean, it could have been written down, but did he have a Bible? Nope. Where did you hear that first? Maybe in the lap of his mother Jochebed. Maybe from the lips of his father. That's remarkable, isn't it? My brother Jerry, in writing his thesis, his master's thesis on the word faith, he actually wrote it on the Greek word pisteuo, dedicated the book about faith to my mother, in whose lap I first heard the word faith, and to my father, in whose life I saw faith every day. Joseph says, I cannot sin, when Potiphar's wife, I cannot sin against whom? Against you and against God. Where'd Joseph get that? Isn't that amazing? Didn't have a Bible. And so Moses is 80 years of age and he's never read the Bible. Perhaps he's read Job. I don't know when Job was written. No one knows when Job was written. It's inspired. Jews recognize it was inspired. Just like if you got a letter from your best friend and it said some things to you that only your best friend would know, you know, that's from your best friend. You can attest to me this letter is from your best friend. And so the inspiration and the canonicity, isn't that a big word? Man, I sound smart all of a sudden. The canonicity, first time I've used that word in 6 years, the canonicity of Job is not in question. He could have read Job, but don't know. By the way, Job never read Job. Isn't that amazing? Job never read chapters 1 and chapters 2. All of a sudden, he just lost everything he's had. David, a man after God's own heart, how much of the Bible did he have? Isn't that remarkable? The faith of David. He's got Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, probably Job, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. Ruth, is that 8 or 9? You and I, listen to this, you and I don't get much faith. We don't think about Genesis through Ruth being books that build us faith and help us grow spiritually. I guess faith is the wrong word there. Those books don't help spirituality. Psalms, now that helps spirituality. I'm going to preach about worship this morning. We're going to be all over Psalms. Why? Help spirituality. Really going to help us spiritually. David did not have Psalms. Proverbs? Nope. Had none of that. And so we have these books, and the names of the book indicate the content of it. Well, if I were you, I'd go to David's class next week, okay? love hearing that guy teach and everything, but took us longer on this than I thought it would, always does. But I want us to spend a little bit more time on the table of contents. Then we're going to get to the text and look at the text to see what it says. Thank you very much.